The relationship becomes the holder of all that stress. And that is part of the divorce rate of the moment and the weight that has felt on the relationship. It's not just people didn't get along. Is that...
Welcome to the School of Greatness. My name is Lewis Howes, former pro athlete turned lifestyle entrepreneur. And each week we bring you an inspiring person or message to help you discover how to unlock your inner greatness. Thanks for spending some time with me today. Now let the class begin.
What is the main thing you would recommend people work on themselves, whether in transition of relationships or in a relationship? Is there one thing that they can always be working on to improve themselves, to be better for other relationships?
If their entire story about the relationship that just ended is about what the other person did wrong to them, something is missing in the story.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that the other person may not have done things that were hurtful to them. But add to it, who were you in this relationship?
Absolutely.
What role did you play? What did you see that you didn't want to pay attention to?
Mm-hmm.
What things do you wish you had done differently? What pieces do you wish that your partner had seen and accepted from you differently?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you wish you would have said less? And where did you wish you would have said more? What do you learn from this relationship? And if when you say what you learn is just that I want to make sure that the next person is...
Right, gives me what I need.
You know, or is less of this or more of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, who do you want to be in the next relationship?
Yeah. How are you going to add value?
A relationship is a story of many people. It's not even a story just of two. Who was too involved in your relationship?
Mm-hmm.
Who was not involved enough? So... there's a cast of characters in a relationship. And it's all those questions that you want to ask when you are in transition. I think that's it. I mean, you can, but they are both directions. If you find yourself with a spotlight only on the other person and you in a passive receptive stance, you're missing a whole pan of the story.
Yeah. And you're probably more of the problem than of the relationship than them, if you're just focusing on them, probably.
A relationship is not about this person and that person. The relationship is what happens in between. This is my view on relationships. It's not an essentialist view, this is this personality and that personality. It's the dynamic.
Right.
You can have a dynamic with a certain partner. You've had dynamics with certain partners. And of course, it was just the right fit between the match and the ignition. And so you had enough inside of you to react with a certain kind of, let's put your jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
But you may meet another person who acts differently. And you may still have a little bit of that jealousy inside of you, but it doesn't get activated because this person is responding very differently to you. And when you say, where were you? They don't say, why do you always have to ask me that question?
Right.
They just say, I just went to do this. It's all good, darling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm right here. I've got you back. And then you don't go into your chest pain, you know, pain. So this is very important to understand. We are not the same person with different partners. We may have certain things that come out depending on what is being sent over to us. So the relationship is a figure eight.
Mm.
It's what I do that makes you do something, that then makes you react to me a certain way, that then draws that out of me, that draws that out of you, and each one actually creates the other.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get that view of relationships, when you come out and you're in transition, you say to yourself, let's say I was with someone who completely disconnected. Okay, they disconnected. Did I push them away?
Mm.
Are there ways in which I contributed sometimes to the disconnection? And that is not self-blame. That is understanding the dynamic. You can take responsibility about things without blaming yourself. And you can hold the other person accountable without blaming them. It's not a blame dance, but it is an understanding of what did I do that made you do what you then did to me that then made me.
Right.
That's the relationship.
Yeah. And if someone's like, you know what, they're listening to you, Esther, they really want to have an amazing relationship. They want to have a rich life, knowing it's not going to be perfect, but they want to create beauty and adventure and play and go through life through the sadness and the adversities and all the things that happen in life. And they're thinking to themselves, how much should I pour into myself for my dreams, my health, my friends and family? How much should I pour into the other person, into their life that I'm creating a partnership with? And how much should I pour into the relationship itself? What would you say to that?
But you asked me, it's different questions, right? What keeps a relationship alive is one question.
Mm.
How much do you invest in a relationship mm-hmm. is a different question. So I'm going to go to the one about what keeps it alive.
Okay.
Because it's part of, and I'm suddenly watching the box and thinking, it is what I'm mostly interested in. Because I work on eroticism.
Mm-hmm.
What keeps us alive? What keeps us hopeful? What keeps us engaged with possibility?
Not physically alive, but connected
physically
alive.
Connected
yes.
to life. Life
yeah.
force, life
yes.
energy.
Yeah.
Why? Because I think everybody understands relationships that are not dead versus relationships that are alive. Teams that are not dead, companies versus companies that are alive. What is flourishing versus surviving?
Mm-hmm.
And because it is part of my personal history, and I come from a background of survivors, of parents who were in concentration camps, and I wanted to understand how do people stay alive when they spend 5 years in a concentration camp. So that's why I've got interested in eroticism. Sexuality is a piece of this. But sexuality is not eroticism. You can have sex every day and feel nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Eroticism is the poetry that accompanies it. It's the meaning we give to it.
Yes.
Right? It's the story that's attached. So eroticism in a relationship is the quality of imagination, curiosity, playfulness, mystery, risk-taking, novelty that people bring to their relationship. Those are the things that I think bring life to a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So in the research of Eli Finkel, it means doing new things together, taking
yeah.
risks beyond your threshold, out of your comfort zone. Because if you do pleasant things that are familiar, it's cozy, it's friendship, it's love, but it's not exciting, it's
mm-hmm.
not erotic, it's not necessarily desire. It's calibrating your expectations. So that you have, and that means diversifying your intimate connections or your deep connections. Doesn't it? You know, for me, intimacy doesn't mean sexual either.
Mm-hmm,
it just means
right.
people that are important to you, that accompany you through the life stages and through the big events in life. These three things, expectations, calibrating expectations, diversifying your social connections, and taking risks and doing new things is the research of Eli Finkel for thriving relationships. But then in that piece, I think play is essential.
It's huge,
playfulness,
right?
It's huge. And it is actually the quality of emotions that is the least talked about.
How often are you playing in your relationship?
All the time. Humor is essential. It's an essential salve and balm in my relationship. I can be in the middle of an argument and then I start to laugh and then I just get perspective and we just kind of ground ourselves back again. It's flirting, it's teasing, it's making fun of, it's that whole realm of we're not really serious and we don't take ourselves that serious.
And what happens when relationships are taking themselves very serious and they're not playing?
Look, I had a teacher who once said to me, if a couple comes to you for therapy and there is absolutely zero humor left, it is diagnostic.
Really?
Now, is it true? You know, nobody has proven that scientifically. But what you know is that humor, and if you listen to my podcast, if you listen to the sessions on Where Should We Begin or on How Is Work, you'll see in the middle of talking about trauma, painful event, major fight, strife, I laugh with them. I manage to see if they can see themselves, if they have a bit of distance, of perspective, if they understand sometimes the absurdity of the things that we get into, the things over which we fight, the way we do it. And even if it's just a glimmer, a smile on the side, on the corner, I know they know that I know that we know. And we, and it creates that complicity. And it invites a new possibility.
Some people may be resisting the humor. They'd be like, no, they want to hold on to the seriousness.
Yes. Yeah. If you want to hold on to righteousness, to I am right, to victimization, to I have the view that is the right, only view that matters, and only my perception and my experience is the truth, then you are in a polarized system that is rigid and unyielding. Humor and play is possibility.
Yes.
Possibility invites change. Change invites healing.
Yes. I want to ask you a few more questions, then I want us to play your game for a little bit. Over the last 2 years, was there anything that came up for you personally in your own inner world that you noticed, oh, there's something, like we talked about it, it created a lot of pressure for people if there were things that came out. Was there anything for you that you were like, huh, there's something I still need to work on myself or need to continue the healing journey of that came out in the last couple of years with being at home and, you know, not doing things the way they used to be?
I will answer this in two ways, the way that I experienced the pandemic. So in the beginning, right after I left you, I went back to New York and I went in lockdown. And basically it was in the, you know, we suddenly kind of, I got gripped with a bit of a panic, and primarily because I thought I can't catch this thing.
Right.
Because if I catch it, I am now suddenly considered elderly. I'm past 60.
But you're 35.
Yeah. For the pandemic, it changed. Right. It suddenly shifted overnight. I became elderly.
Yep.
And that meant I wasn't sure if we entered the hospital, me or Jack, that we will pass the triage.
Interesting.
And he's older than me. And I got really, really scared. I had a lot of post-traumatic stress symptoms that are very much connected to the Holocaust and to my family experience. That sense that overnight, this whole life I have built could just disappear like this. And it was irrational. I was terrified that Jack would die. To the point, you wanted to know about humor in my relationship?
Yes.
So we are in the middle of construction at the time, and the workers, and at the point he comes to me and he says, I asked the workers to dig a hole in the garden. I said, oh yeah, why? He said, so that when I die, you can just roll me right in.
Oh my God. Wow, talk about humor.
And I cracked up because he showed me, girl, you're gripped in fear.
Yeah.
And I just started to laugh and I just realized, no, he's not dead. Because I was ready to stop construction. I said, we're not making this.
No one can come here within 1,000 yards of...
It's more like we will not survive.
No way.
When it's post-traumatic, it's trauma is the word, right? So I really was very, very, very scared. And his humor diffused it for me and just brought me back and said, we're continuing to build. We're going to live. We're going to survive. Don't worry, girl. It's like, so this was one. And it slowly, you know, I entered into the long term of the pandemic and it dissolved. And that's when I understood, and this came out of that.
Uh-huh.
I missed my friends, I missed my dinner parties, I missed intimacy, and I created a host of different group experiences, pods.
Mm-hmm.
I had a movie club
on
Zoom on three continents.
Oh, that's cool.
I had a book club. I had a yoga group that met 4 times a week still till now, that is over 2 continents.
Wow, that's cool.
And I had a hiking group. I had a swimming group in the summer. And then one day I said, I need to play. And I need to continue to have conversations where I learn something new. I was so freaking tired of talking about the pandemic all the time.
Sure.
And I said, I'm going to create a game. Not having any idea of what this thing was going to become and what it represented. I just thought, I want to do something creative and I want people to be able to talk about something that isn't just like, you know, when you live 6 months like this in lockdown, you begin to have the same conversation.
Of course, of course.
So I just thought, how am I going to make couples Have fun. Get energized, you know, be curious about each other, talk about something else.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, we need to play, mm-hmm. because play is a container. Play gives you the possibility to take risks, to talk about things that you would otherwise not talk about, because it's under the guise of play. Play allows you to ask questions that you would otherwise not ask, certainly not to your partner, because we get more shy with the people that we live with than mm-hmm. with strangers
yeah,
sometimes.
Really? Interesting, yeah.
You know, you're more daring to ask sometimes questions strangers. To strangers.
That you're never going
to
see again.
Or people you've just met.
Right.
Than the person you live with for decades
yeah.
on end.
And that's interesting.
So play became very, very central. When you play, you still are able to lift yourself from the ground, and it means you can enter the world of imagination and where the mm-hmm. rules are different.
Mm-hmm.
And every child at this moment, you know, around the Ukrainian crisis, you can see when kids are still able to play, it is the moments when they are not in hypervigilance. So it is an essential survival skill.
Yes, yes.
Underrated. And from that place came...
That's great.
Where should we begin?
It's one of the key things in relationship and in life, is what I'm hearing you
it's
say.
It's essential.
It's essential.
It's essential.
Now, here's another side question before we get into this.
Play is problem solving. Play is creativity. Play is risk taking. Play mm-hmm. is...
spontaneity. It's all these things.
It's the other side of fear.
Well, you can't... When you're playing, and as an athlete, when I'm playing, I'm not thinking about other things.
Yeah.
If you're playing, you get
it's
in the
flow.
Zone. Your
it's flow.
Flow.
Yeah.
And you can't put your attention somewhere else. When you do, that's when you mess up the game, right? You're not in your best flow state when you're thinking about something else. So play allows you to get out of that,
yes.
which I think is really powerful. And my friend Matt, he's like, I'm always playing with
when
him.
You play, do you play for fun or do you play for winning?
To win?
Yes.
No, I play for both. Yeah. I used to only play to win.
Yeah.
Now I play for fun, but I also want to, you know, it's like me and my girlfriend, we play cards a lot. We have a game that we started playing over the holidays called Nerds. It's kind of like speed solitaire, right? Mm-hmm. Where you both play and there's like some shared space in the middle where you play as well. And we play for fun, but I want to win. So it's like I'm competitive, but it's okay. I can just play and have fun too.
And you can appreciate a good game.
Absolutely.
That you lost.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because it makes me want to go again. Let's play again, you know? So I love playing. Yeah. But I used to be only, I have to play to win. And it was like an obsession. And now that's shifted to, I'm still a very competitive human, but I can play.
So I used to play without having to create a situation where there is a winner and a loser so mm-hmm. that I could have fun.
That's great.
And then it was the same idea here.
That's what you
created
this.
There is no winner. It's
that's
a storytelling
great.
Game. So there is no winner so that you don't have to compete
Absolutely.
So that you can have fun.
That's great.
Some people are like, yeah.
I want to get into this in a second, but there's one thing I wanted to ask you about this last couple of years. If someone's listening or watching and they're thinking to themselves, here's Esther Perel. She is one of the top people in the world on healing and therapy and connection. And she's been studying this and created best-selling books and podcasts and games. And this is your life's mission. And yet she has, you know, post-traumatic stress or things that come up for her still. And she's the expert in this. Is there anything that you feel like you still need work healing in order to let certain things go? Or are these things always going to be with us at certain times? Different stresses or pains or wounds or PTSD from the past of our individual lives?
Look, the notion that when you heal, something utterly disappears is one component of healing.
Mm-hmm.
But the other part is that you need a bigger trigger to reactivate an old wound, but there is a whole new range
right.
where the wound can live without being activated.
Right, you've healed a certain amount of triggers, but there might be a bigger.
So you know you.
Right.
You come back from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from you know all the wars that people have fought here. And you, or you are a refugee from Syria or from Afghanistan, I mean, all sides, you may not at every siren jump anymore. But if suddenly...
But if there's a bomb.
Yes, you will jump.
Gotcha.
So the range and the response, mm-hmm. you know, to the danger shifts.
Gotcha.
That's the piece around healing. I think for me, it was a real surprise, that this fear that I got to experience. I didn't remember that. It had been a long time.
Because you're constantly doing the work. You're constantly in the...
I thought I have kind of created a life where I have a sense of ownership. I have a sense of control. I have a sense... But I always live with dread.
You do?
I do.
Still today?
That my whole life.
Live with dread like...
That every minute something could happen.
The sky could fall and...
The whole thing could disappear.
Really?
Because that is the core story of my family. And mm-hmm. But I don't have the dread all the time. But when it grips,
In
the past, it would grip without anything happening. It just was like happening to me because I had a day where I just didn't know what I was going to do with my life. So it disappeared. I could talk about it, but I wouldn't necessarily feel it. Mm-hmm. It's physical. It's visceral. It's like you described the chest. For me, it's the gut. It says, right. But when the pandemic arrives, it's a trigger that is strong enough to bring back that sense of dread.
Absolutely.
And at that time, I wasn't aware of my dread. I was feeling my dread.
Yeah.
That's very different. That's what I mean by the external versus the internal.
I am so excited to travel this summer. And have you ever thought about all the people that make a vacation truly great? The pilot that gets you to your destination, the hotel concierge that knows all the best spots, the chefs that make the incredible food that you eat. You know, outstanding talent is crucial for a successful business also. And if you're hiring, you can find talent for roles like these and more when you try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. Now, ZipRecruiter uses a powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. And get this, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter, they get a quality candidate within the first day. That is so powerful for a growing business. So travel to this easy to remember web destination, ZipRecruiter.com/greatness. That's where you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GREATNESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Now, what do people struggle with? People have struggled with prolonged uncertainty. Here are the 5 things of the pandemic that have affected relationships the most.
Yep.
One is a prolonged sense of uncertainty. It's not just that you're not sure when this is going to end, but you're not sure about you not being sure. Okay, the distinct keeps coming and going all the time. Mm-hmm. 1 minute you say it's gone, the next minute you realize, oh, it's not gone at all.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That. Then it's the notion of what we experienced was a collapse of all the boundaries. Here I am. I'm at home, I'm on my chair, at my kitchen table, and I am a therapist, and a supervisor, and a podcaster, and a mother, and a friend, and a wife, and I haven't left the chair,
I'm
still just in sweatpants with the, you know, and I'm like, where is work, where is life, where is morning, where is night, where it's just like, all the roles have collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not made like this. We are physical people, and we are spatially oriented, and we change location for our activities, we change clothes for our activities, and they help us enter the role. Now I'm going to work, now I'm going to play sports, now I'm going to the club, now I'm going out, now I'm going to visit my mother. And
yes.
I feel different, I look different, I wear different, I have rituals, I have things, a different bag, a different racket. None of this. Do you know what it means when your entire arsenal of rituals that give meaning and frame your parts dissolves, you get exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the collapse of boundaries. Then there was the sense of ambiguous loss. You know, we lost spontaneity, we lost plans, we lost the weddings, the graduations, the parties, the promotions,
sports, games, everything. Yeah.
It's not, there is the loss of death, but there is that other loss, the buildings that are standing, but they're empty.
Ooh.
They're physically present, but emotionally vacated. We have the grandparents and the parents that are physically gone, but emotionally present. We call that ambiguous loss, when you are either physically present and psychologically gone, or psychologically present and physically gone.
Yes.
That ambiguous loss became a part of what then Adam Grant began to describe in the languishing. Languishing is you're not depressed, you're just like lifeless, flat, listless. Nothing is really giving you the sense of meaning and purpose and joy that you generally want. That has happened in your relationship. And what happens when you are in a period of liminality like this, where the big dilemmas are not getting answered, is that all the unknowns are filtering onto your relationships. And the relationship becomes the holder of all that stress. And that is part of the divorce rate of the moment. And the weight that has felt on the relationships. It's not just people didn't get along. It's that people needed in the relationships to deal from the political polarization to the racial reckoning to the economic insecurity to the ambiguous loss to the prolonged uncertainty. Of that fell on relationships. This is the story of the last 2 years, that people know, they feel it, but they don't necessarily articulate it.
Hard to make a relationship last if you don't have the tools and you're not willing to work through it.
How do you stay grounded when the ground itself is moving?
It's quicksand.
It's the great adaptation of this moment.
Yeah.
And so relationships began to see the cracks inside their relationship, and people also began to see the light that shines through the cracks, both ends.
Yes. Well, play is key in a relationship, and I'm glad that I'm playful and I'm down for this game. Where should we begin?
I'm going to hook you to this game so that you and Marta
we play
get
it all
to
the
tell
time.
Stories to each other like never before.
This is a game that came to you. You know, this is one of the things that came to you during the pandemic because you wanted to have creativity, you wanted to have play, connection, all these different things. So you created this game, Where Should We Begin? A game of stories by Esther Perel. And there's no winner, there's no loser, so it's not the type of game I'm used to playing. Yes, exactly. So we both have a set of cards. Do I pick any or should I give you one?
No, you pick from mine. I'm going to have you pick from mine.
Should I go first or you go first?
Yeah, you go first.
You sure?
Yeah.
Let's go the safest one. Okay, so then I pick, and do I get to say if I want to answer it or not? Or
no, you have to answer.
I have to answer it. Okay. A rule I secretly love to break. A rule.
When are you rule breaking?
I feel like I'm always breaking the...
But it's a story.
Okay, remember. I tell a story. Okay.
It's a story.
Okay.
Right.
Rule I always
because
break.
I actually think stories, relationships are stories.
Mm-hmm.
Stories are bridges to each other. Stories bind us. So
here's a rule I like to break consistently.
Yes.
Since we're going on the story of play, in some ways I feel like I've emotionally and physically matured and grown up. In other ways, I feel like I've kept this childlike curiosity inside of me. Mm. It's one of the reasons why I love to interview people and do the podcast. It's one of the reasons I try to make people feel uncomfortable when I meet them for the first time by asking them questions that maybe they wouldn't have answered with a stranger. So one of the things I love to break is in my relationship is trying to bring play to every moment. Even when it's stressful.
Do you like to be goofy?
Love to be goofy, love to be silly, and tease. And I think there's a difference between teasing and bullying. I don't want to be a bully.
It's a world apart.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to be a bully, but I love to be playful and tease and just throw a little, what about this? You know, a little comment here. Martha, she says that she thinks I was like, a Mexican in another life because she says I have the humor not of a white person from America, but of a Mexican, because I'm teasing and playful. And I have a sarcasm that she says is similar to the way that she grew up. So I think for me, I don't take anything too seriously. And especially in the relationship, which why I love that you said play is one of the keys to success. And which is why if someone is not reciprocal, then it becomes challenging if they're not wanting to play
with
you.
It's like throwing a ball that drops the floor.
Yeah, you're playing ping pong and it just with yourself. Yeah.
Yes.
So that is a rule I love to secretly break is just being a child, having childlike energy, but having maturity at the same time.
Nice.
Yes. Okay. So then what? I finished the card and now it's your turn. Right
now we're doing it like this. But sometimes I put two cards and then I get to pick for the other person or people pick themselves. Then we have little orange tokens, in which when you play with a group, we can put pressure on the card.
Ooh.
And then we have the group says, we want you to talk about this. So it becomes very...
To make some kind of like have someone do it, yes.
So there's all kinds of variations, but it's...
I kind of want to do a sexual one with you. I think we took all those cards out, but here, I'll let you just choose one.
You asked for us to take them out, so I was going to go...
I know, I should have.
Oh, God. The most humiliated I've ever felt.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God.
The most embarrassing or humiliating story.
I can tell you immediately the thing. It's. I'm like 10, 11. So
okay.
It goes
what is
back
it?
A long time. I stole a candy.
Oh, that's it?
Well, you don't want to be caught.
You got caught.
I got caught.
By who? Your parents? By that store
person?
By a person
that was waiting in line.
They saw you.
That saw me said to the person.
She stole this. No way. What did you have to do?
I gave it back.
Oh, man.
And she said, you have to pay for it. I said, I don't want it. She said, you have to pay for it. I said, I don't have the money. She said, you leave me something and then you come back with the money.
Wow. So you have to pay for it even though you didn't take it?
Well, I didn't have the money.
Oh, wow.
So I went home. I got the money. Because I had to leave my school bag.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, you had to leave like some collateral, some like your ID or your phone at the time. Yes.
Yes, I had to leave collateral. And
bring money back. That's so embarrassing. It's humiliating.
It's like, you know, yeah, because if you're going to take something, you're not supposed to take the whole point of it.
Is then I get caught.
Is not to be caught.
You know, it's interesting. I probably love this because I bet other people have conversations when you answer and then it triggers something in someone else.
Yes.
I stole for a couple years from, I don't know, 10, 11, somewhere around there, 11, 12.
What was
candy,
your team?
Candy all the time.
Also candy.
Right, candy. And I thought I was so smooth. I never got caught from a store. But one time I went to this was the most humiliating probably and embarrassing and probably most shameful thing, you know, as a kid growing up. My dad brought me and a friend of mine after basketball practice to go to one of his clients. He sold life insurance. And we had to drive, I don't know, 45 to an hour away to a farm. He was like a client of his at a farm in Ohio. And we go there and my dad's like, okay, you kids like hang out on the farm or whatever in the house and walk around. I got to talk to Mr. So-and-so for an hour to go over stuff. So we're walking around, nosy little kids, you know, 12 years old, go down in the basement and I'm like opening up drawers. I'm doing stuff I shouldn't do. And I see a wallet. I take out the wallet. I open it up. There's a $20 bill and a $5 bill. And we're looking at each other. We're like, should we do this? I'm like, he will never know. I take the $5. My friend takes the $20. I get woken up that night at, I don't know, 4 a.m. in the morning. And my dad is hovering over me. At this time, my dad's pretty intimidating still. And he's hovering over me. Did you steal from so-and-so money? And I go, no. Right away, I'm like, am I dreaming? Am I awake? I'm like, no, I'm defending myself, right? Lied right to my dad. And he goes, Mr. So-and-so was going to buy food for like his cows, right? Or for his like animals on the farm. And he doesn't have the money to go buy the food, like it's gone. I go, I don't know what happened. You know, I just lied. But I was also like waking up, I was like disoriented. And then he calls my friend's parents and he admits to it. And it was the most humiliating, embarrassing, shameful thing because I had to drive back alone. My friend didn't have to go, but I drove back for the hour with my parents in the front seat, me in the back seat, just so ashamed. And I had to go face this guy and say, I'm sorry, with like the most, you know, he was just so frustrated and angry and upset. And I never stole again after that. So I don't know, did you steal after that moment?
No, you know, my moment is I'm taking the thing and somebody goes like this.
No, they did that?
Yes.
No way.
I still have the motion.
Oh my gosh.
And it's like you freeze.
Oh, my gosh.
The shame. The humiliation.
Shame. I'll never forget this guy's face. Like I was 12 years old, right? Okay.
Oops.
Okay. If I could whisper something in the ear of my younger self, I would say, and I'd probably say something very loving. Part of me wanted to be playful, but I'd probably say something loving because that's what I needed to hear. I'd probably say that you are loved, you matter, and it's all going to be okay. That's what I would say because I think that's what I needed to hear the most. And it's funny because I've said this so many times on my show, so my audience is going to get tired of me saying this, but I'm going to show you this. Over a year ago, I put a photo of my younger self on my screensaver, right? I've talked about this so many times now. And so for the last year, this is my therapist, Clara, had me do work on my inner child, on healing the relationship that I had with myself back then, and really having intimate conversations, exercises with the 5, 6, 7-year-old that was sexually abused. I've talked about that with you before, which I never really fully healed, you know, that whole conversation with. And it's been a beautiful journey to have intimacy, connection, you know, and bridge the gap from 5, 6, 7 till now and be able to have a conversation between that space and time and really bring the two together, you know, my inner child into me through healing.
So what would this one say to you?
What would he say to me? Oh my gosh. That's a good...
Actually.
That's really good.
May I bring him back?
Yeah.
What does he say to you?
Oh my gosh. He probably says, let me think, I'm getting my heart here. He says, thank you. Thank you for being willing to be courageous in all these scary emotions. All the scary emotions that I'm feeling right now, the things that I'm uncertain about, the things that I'm afraid of. Thank you for having the courage to dive in and be, put all your emotions on the table, address the messiness, handle it all, and supporting me in finding peace and healing that I've always wanted. That's what it would say, yeah. So, yeah, I know it's crazy. Crazy. Oh, okay. Okay, I'm going to the next one. This is what I do. I laugh when things get deep. I get deep, and then I'm like, okay.
You laugh where your tears are streaming down
your face. Of course, of course. Okay, this is you.
Oops. I would sell everything to be able to. It's interesting. I don't have a dream. You know, I live a lot of my dreams at this moment. So I don't feel like I would sell. But I think if I was to, I would sell everything to remain healthy.
Yeah.
Or I would sell everything for my kids or my partner to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And if I needed to, like, I would go everywhere in the world, just to make sure that if there's something that can keep them, it's not just alive, it's healthy.
Yeah.
Because I don't want them just
not
to...
Not just suffering and alive, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that at this point, that's the only...
Is that the biggest fear for you?
Yes, but you see, when I say I live with dread, you jumped like, really? Because it's not the, you know... I live with the fear of loss. It's not dread, just bad things happening. What's underneath is the fact that my parents had lost everybody, and so their entire families, they were the only two that came out. And this is part of my DNA. And so the fear of loss, of traumatic loss, and the grief, that's what I fear. Yeah. So health, or selling everything, or, you know, imagining myself, you know, cruising the world to find the best doctor that could help
solutions,
me.
Yeah.
Yes, with something is part of preventing that loss. You know.
Have you had major losses?
No, except actually, I on a personal level have not. But I often, you know, if one of them drives, I often at night.
You're worried.
You know, I just. I've never said don't go, but right, I just right. like
That's
the little call when they arrive.
You're like my mom too.
I can easily imagine accidents.
Oh man!
I can easily imagine. Yes, I am a catastrophizer in that sense. You know, So what does therapy do? It allows you to just in your mind. It's like no, this you're
calms
fine.
The mind.
You go out. It calms you, but I still like the call.
Of course, there's your assurance. You
know, so the fear is loss. Mm-hmm. And the dread is the manifestation of that fear. Mm. So I would sell everything. Actually, I don't know what it's like. I could put it like that. I would sell everything to be able to live without dread.
Ooh.
That would probably be the...
What would it take from you?
I don't know.
To process, let that go.
I look at people who don't have those fears, and I think that they are free of this. It's like, what does life look like without worry?
Peaceful.
You know,
peaceful
they
inside.
Have other things.
Yeah,
I mean,
other stresses.
They have other things,
stresses,
but
yeah.
It's an amazing thing when I see people who don't have, you know, that is not their thing.
Yeah.
I don't have their things.
You don't have jealousy or insecurity.
No,
yeah.
I don't have that.
Do you work with a therapist yourself?
I have. I don't work with a therapist at this moment, but I have over the many years of my life. Yes.
Do you think it's important for therapists to have therapists?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You first of all, if you don't, then you will be triggered by things that people bring into your office, and you will be projecting things on them that don't belong to them. We call that countertransference.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there is what people put on you, but there is what you put on them.
Because you have something unresolved.
Or there is what you can't work with because of what is happening inside of you.
Oh, wow.
So it's an
essential.
So you've
got to be cleansing yourself constantly, probably.
It's essential.
Interesting. Where do you think, you said you haven't had a therapist in a while or worked with one in a while. Where do you think... What would I go to today? Yeah, what would be available for you today if you were doing it?
Today I would go to a coach because I need practical help. it's less internal at this moment.
Yes.
It's more practical things.
What's holding you back from...
I don't. I am a person who likes to receive help.
Yeah,
so I don't...
You just haven't found the right coach.
I wrote a whole piece recently about asking for help. In the blog, and because I realized that it's very easy for me to ask for help. Actually, when we met early on, I asked for help.
Absolutely.
And I just thought,
I've never done this marketing stuff.
Yes,
but yeah.
Like I know nothing about marketing. You're like the genius marketer. I'm a therapist who suddenly finds that, and I just thought I know people and they can help me, and I don't feel like I have no problem saying I know nothing about this. But I trust what I do know a lot about, and this is new for me. So I don't experience it as belittling or admitting or vulnerable. Or I think it's an amazing thing to ask for help. And by the way, I did ask on social. I asked people, you know, how do you feel about asking for help? And like 70-something% of people said, I don't do it. I don't like it. That doesn't make me feel good, etc. And then I said, and how do you feel when other people ask you for help? And the same 70% said, I love it. And I'm thinking, you know what? It's like when other people ask, you don't think they're stupid, they don't know, they're vulnerable, they're you know, you think...
You want to help.
You want to help.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you think that when you ask for help, other people enjoy that too?
Right.
So I'm big into the asking for help these days, and... Therapy is a piece of that. At this moment, therapy is not the thing
that you need.
But that doesn't mean that, you know, Jack thinks I should meditate. That actually,
so maybe you need a meditation coach.
I do, but in movement. I get calm when
I when you're walking or hiking.
Don't sit. That does not work for me. And
what's the one thing that triggers you the most that you would like to evolve beyond?
What's the thing that
irritates you or triggers you or frustrates you?
Bureaucrats. Rigidity. Rigidity, which is the opposite of playfulness.
Yeah, not flexibility. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And arbitrariness. Rules for the sake of rules.
Yeah.
Bureaucracy, you know, in the big sense of the word. And bureaucrats as a whole, you know, that, you know, things that, you know, rigidity, which means that you write, you don't listen to others, you make your point. I mean, conversations that are not conversations, people that yell at each other for the sake of yelling at each other, cancel culture from all sides. Yes. I mean, my work is about helping people have the difficult conversations that they need to have, want to have, don't know how to have. As long as they want to, I can do something.
Right.
If they think they know it all, and if they think they know you even better than you know yourself, and that they have no curiosity, I find that challenging.
Yeah.
I love curiosity. I hate... What's the opposite of curiosity?
Fixed. Yeah.
Yeah, certainty. But certainty is the enemy of change.
Right. I want to go one more question each. Yeah. I want to make sure I'm respectful of time. I think we got about 10 more minutes.
Yeah.
Before I ask, I want to pick it, but you just brought something up to me that I had a conversation with another therapist, Dr. Romney, and she speaks all about narcissism.
Yes, she was the keynote speaker at a conference that I went to this year too.
And this video got so much attention that I did with her in this interview. And we don't have to go into it for too long, but you were just mentioning how people have that don't want to do the work, right? You mentioned they're fixed, they're shouting for shouting, they're not willing to look at themselves. And she was mentioning how it's really hard to diagnose a narcissist because they have to be willing to come to therapy, and most of them will never do it unless they're forced to. In your practice, do you interact with a lot of narcissists? And she also mentions how it's almost impossible. I don't want to say exact words she said, but I think she said it's almost impossible for a narcissist to change and evolve unless they do therapy every day type of, mentality where they really are practicing this thing on a consistent basis. And I'm sure there's a spectrum of narcissistic personality traits and a range of how strong someone is in that. What's your thoughts on narcissism in general? And can people change or evolve out of it?
I can answer it clinically and culturally. I mean, yeah. Maybe we should start by talking about like Christopher Lash talked about it. We do live in a narcissistic culture.
Selfie culture, the
we
likes.
Live in a culture of narcissism. Once you are continuously evaluating yourself, proving yourself, performing, demonstrating yourself, posting about yourself, engaging in fake news about yourself, you are in a narcissistic culture that, criteria, diagnosis accompany the culture of the day. In the 19th century, we talked about hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
We do not talk much about hysteria today because we realized that the majority of these hysteric women, supposedly hysteric women, were actually women who had experienced sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
They were not hysterical, they were traumatized.
Yes.
Narcissism is the word that we come back with on the 21st century. Stress and anxiety and depression was the 20th century. So every century and every culture has its expressions through mental illness or mental manifestations, okay? Eating disorders exist in some cultures and not in others. A diagnosis, a personality disorder, doesn't just exist like that without a background. So that means that it's easy to make these issues very personal, but they are also societal. That said, I have sat with people who have a whole range of narcissistic tendencies. To get to saying somebody is a narcissist, somebody is depressed, somebody is, I think that there's more to us than just that.
Right.
But you see a lot of people with narcissistic tendencies, and you see a lot of people who are not just exhibiting it with manifest narcissism, but there's a whole other form of narcissism that is called covert narcissism, which we talk about much less because we don't name it in those ways.
What is the difference?
That is a long conversation. In
the short form, what is the...
Power can come from above and power can come from underneath. You can have power through victimization. You can make people feel guilty all the time. You can be passive aggressive. You can make people continuously feel that they are responsible for your life, that if they don't do what you want, that you may kill yourself. There's loads of ways to make other people submit themselves to you.
And that would be considered covert?
Those are expressions of more covert.
Covert.
Narcissism.
It's not like this domineering.
That's right.
But
you can
it's a psychological.
People from the top, and you can control people from underneath.
Yes,
I think that there is a certain profile at this point of when we say narcissist, everybody has five or six associations that are quite similar. And this is really a whole other conversation.
Sure.
But what I will say is that yes, I have sat with people who have very little regard. People who bring everything on to themselves. People who see everything as a reflection of themselves. People who are charming when they need to seduce you. And then once they think they have you, they turn and they go into the next people who they need to charm, but those that they have already recruited are disregarded and discarded. So those,
they got the most out of them already, yeah.
You know, people who can lie pathologically to you, people who have very little empathy for what is happening. So there is a cluster of things. But I think for me, I tend to look at behaviors and I tend to look at interactions because I'm a relational therapist and I'm a systems-oriented therapist. And so I less spend my time labeling a personality. I think it's useful on occasion, but it is not my primary vocabulary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But she's very, very eloquent about it.
Yes, yes. You know? We'll have to have you back on to do a whole 2-hour conversation on that another time, because there's a lot to that.
I do not want to talk about complex topics
in a short amount of time.
Because it doesn't do them justice, and I don't like to reinforce notions that have not been examined.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But that are easy to grab on.
We'll have you back on for that. I'll do one final card, and then I think I've got to make sure I'm respecting the time.
But you're going to touch on me. Yep. What is that?
Okay. I'm my own worst enemy when... It's interesting.
You know what?
You want to give me a different one?
Yes.
Okay.
I want to give you this.
Okay.
Because of what happened just a few minutes before.
The last time I cried was, yesterday, you know, in terms of, my father just died 2 months ago. Mm. And so I've been crying a lot, you know, every couple of days. I hear a song that really connects me to a memory, to him, mm-hmm. and to the whole... It was a sad experience because he got into a car accident 17 years ago, had a severe brain trauma, was in a coma for 3 months. Then he woke up. He went in a different country, in New Zealand at the time. I was in college. Then he came back, and it was like my dad was physically here, but emotionally, mentally, and spiritually not.
Ambiguous loss.
Yes.
This is it.
I never was able to fully grieve.
That's ambiguous loss.
My father. He was physically here, but the emotion.
The same person.
And every interaction I had with him was reminding me of the loss. Was, I'm grateful he's here, and it's great to experience some time with him. Mm-hmm. But every time I go and say hello, he says, Lewis, right? Didn't you used to play? What sport did you play growing up? Where did you go to school again? So he could have a conversation with you and speak conversationally, but it was the same story over and over again. I'm needing to remind my father
for
17 years of the memory loss that he had. Show him photos of him with me, taking photos of me playing sports. The second half of my life with him was beautiful. He showed up, he transformed, he overcame a lot of the anger and resentment he had. And I had two different lives with him. When I was 13 before, I had some love, some scary with him. Then after 13, it was like this incredible friendship. So it's like I lost my dad, mm-hmm. but he was physically here. And every year there was some type of health scare. He had a couple strokes, a heart attack. He had multiple surgeries from the accident, just the complications from the accident. And so every year I didn't know if he was going to survive or not. And is it going to happen this year? Okay, he's in the hospital now. Is he going to make it? Do I need to be there? In this 17-year cycle of learning to accept something and doing my best to be okay with it. And accepting and loving where it's at, you know. So for me, it was 17 years of I wouldn't say numbing, but it was acceptance and just like managing it the best I could. And then when he passed in February, a couple months ago, it was, just full circle, kind of like going back 17 years ago and reliving that, and then reliving my whole childhood and allowing myself to be, to have a full range of emotions. And I think it's beautiful because...
Do you feel like this time actually you can fully grieve?
I feel like I can.
Because this is ambiguous loss, what you just described.
Yeah.
Can't grieve, can't mourn because he's there, but he's not there.
Yeah.
And this one gives it... Now you can experience the full range.
Absolutely. I didn't feel like I could.
Yeah.
And I feel like I have a more spiritual connection to him now than in the last 17 years. Yeah. You know, every night I'm connecting with him in my own way and in my little meditation room. And, you know, throughout the days, there are things that come up where I feel the spiritual presence, and it's a beautiful, it's sad, it's beautiful, it's emotional, it's a wide range of emotions. And, you know, there's a lot of sadness I have because I wish it wasn't that way. But I also...
relief.
I have some relief, and I'm also doing my best to create meaning from the whole thing. So that it's not just this thing I'm frustrated with constantly, but like, you know what? I probably wouldn't be doing this without that pain and sadness and loss. I wouldn't be a curious, hungry. I wouldn't have been as resourceful if I had him there. So, yeah, I mean, I've been crying a lot. I've been crying a lot. And it's been beautiful to have a safe environment in my relationship with someone who allows that. Because I think that's hard for some people to allow that, especially for men to be able to express their full range of emotions and for that their partner to feel safe with that too. So I feel very grateful. But
absolutely.
Hasn't been fun, but it's also been allowing me to have like peace with it.
It's an amazing thing that if you ask people, when's the last time you laughed? Nobody has to justify laughing.
Mm-hmm. But crying.
But crying, people have to justify it. They have to.
It's interesting you ask
right?
that.
I mean, it is the absolute natural emotion to feel in sadness, in grief, in loss. What
but crying.
Man, woman, they, them, whoever.
I had a woman on 2 days ago who hasn't cried in years. And I had a man on yesterday who hasn't cried in, I think, 10 or 12 years. And it's interesting. It's like there's something there, I think, to be able to have the full range.
Of course.
I'm not saying you need to cry all day long or something, but allowing yourselves to feel. But that's probably for a whole nother conversation. So.
I mean, I would say that it's hard for people to really fully say yes if you can't fully say no.
Mm.
And it is hard for people to fully laugh if you can't also cry.
Mm.
If something is funny, you automatically do this. If something is sad, the fact that you stay like that, affectless, or that you repress it, or that you hold it in, or that you don't even notice it, or that the thing is coming down your face and you don't even realize. I've had people tear in my office while they say, I never cry.
What does that mean when someone isn't able to fully laugh or fully cry?
What would it be like if a person comes into this world and doesn't scream? I mean, if a baby doesn't scream when they come out, you think they're death at birth.
Mm.
What is it like when people make love and make no noise? When it's impossible. I mean, you're a sports person. You know that if you lift something, you make noise.
You scream, you grunt here.
You know, the voice is, it's just, what does it mean when this whole thing is closed off?
There's something inside that's missing or dead or trapped.
Or trapped.
Yeah.
Or was shoved down or can't come out. But for sure, it is a blockage.
Yeah. We've got another session we're gonna have to do because I'm feeling the time, and I want to be respectful of what you have next after this. But I could talk to you for hours. This game is a lot of fun. Where should we begin? A Game of Stories by Esther Perel. So make sure you guys get this. Get a few for your friends. Have it on your coffee table.
Season.
Wedding season, graduation, schools, parties, births. All these things are happening now. So this is a way for you to connect. I think this is brilliant because I don't think most people have these type of intimate conversations. This is something
it's
that I live by.
As intimate as you want, by the way.
Yeah.
You can stay perfectly light and
you can just do
fun.
Sexual fun talk, and you can go deeper
indeed,
and all these different things.
Indeed.
So get the game. It's going to be powerful for you. And I think the world is craving connection and conversations in this way.
You know what I was thinking? If people want to have an opportunity to have a conversation like we have, we're casting for Housework.
Yes.
For the work-related podcast. So they're live.
Where can they go to do that?
EstherPerel.com/podcast.
Okay.
And
there's a casting on there.
There's a casting on there.
What do they get if they're selected?
A 3-hour session with me, recorded anonymously.
So they don't say their names
Never.
Or yeah.
No, all identifiable features are removed so that it becomes a conversation for all of us. And
it's sacred, still.
Yeah.
They get a free session.
Yeah.
Wow. That's You're in high demand. You're like, a wait list is like 3 years, so that's a big deal. So if they go to estherperel.com/podcast, they can apply for that to see if they can get a session
from you. If you want to work on a relationship issue that pertains to work. And the fascinating thing is that it seems that people have a harder time talking about their romantic relationship than about work.
Why is that?
That's for when I come back.
Okay. So many topics for the next conversation. Excited. We've got this. We've got narcissism. We've got the trapped emotions of not crying. All these things. They can go to game.estherperel.com to get this game, Where Should We Begin? I recommend you guys getting it. Esther Perel, everywhere on social media. Where are you spending the most time these days on social media? Where should they? Is it Instagram or Instagram? Okay,
Instagram.
Cool. So we'll go there. And also your two podcasts. Make sure you guys subscribe. They're both on Spotify, yeah. Right? Powerful.
Where Should We Begin?
Yes, Where Should We Begin is life-changing. If you want to master your relationships, you're going to hear so many crazy, fascinating stories about people.
Maybe you should say it's life couples therapy.
Life couples therapy. It's fascinating. You've done how many seasons now? Two, three?
No, six.
Six! I've only heard the first two, so I need to get caught up. Okay. So six episodes, six seasons of that, and then you've got How's Work, which is all about work dynamics.
Yep.
You got some fascinating stories there, so I'm very excited about those. Make sure you guys subscribe. Get the book, two books you have.
Mating in Captivity. It's the state of affairs.
Yes, get those books. We'll link all that stuff up as well. Two final questions for you that I've asked you before. This is your fourth time on, but I want to see if it's changed after the pandemic. Imagine it's your last day on Earth many years away, but you get to live as long as you want to live. And you've gotten rid of dread in your life, right? So you've got no more dread. But for whatever reason, it's the last day for you, many years away. And you've got to take everything with you that you've created. Or we don't have access to the games, the books, the podcasts anymore for whatever reason. But you get to leave behind three lessons to the world, three truths that you would share. And this is all we would have. What would those three lessons be for you?
The quality of your relationships is determined, or I would put it that, the quality of your relationships determines the quality of your lives. When people tell me, you've changed my life, when people stop me on the street to talk about the podcast all over the world, but what they say is, you changed my life, you accompanied me through my relationship, my divorce, my affair, I just feel like I have a reason to be here. It's a tremendous affirmation. It's what I've done for others, what it means for them to have been in conversation with me. And this is true for my friends. This is true for my patients or for the people who listen. So what I take with me is the people who would tell me what my presence has meant in their life. And the third one is... I live with three men, my husband and my two sons, and I really, if I go, I want them to take all the love, the joy, the fun, the laughter that we have experienced together and go and experience it with other women.
Mm.
They happen to be into women, so they should all go to other women.
Right, right.
That, wow. You know, that I will continue to live in them through the relationships that they will have with others.
Wow, that's beautiful. I want to acknowledge you, Esther, for the way you continually show up in this world, because I think I've known you for like 6, 7, 8 years. And the conversations we have here and off of the podcast are always so inspiring to me and also to so many people that watch and listen. And you're amazing at what you do, and you help so many people. So I really acknowledge you for consistently living a life of service to help people on the thing that is the most important, which is the quality of their relationships. The relationships with others and work, intimacy, and with themselves. So I really appreciate you and acknowledge you for giving us the wisdom and advice we need to help mend these relationships. My final question is, what's your definition of greatness?
I would love to hear what... 1,000 people must have defined this for you. And I'm curious what I answered on other times about this one. I think that I like the sentence from my friend Terry Real, who you should have on the podcast, and who will talk to you about narcissism and grandiosity in people.
Okay.
on the other side of grandiosity, you know, it would be a great conversation to have with you about grandiosity, but greatness is when you can see yourself as a flawed individual and still hold yourself in high regard.
I don't think you've shared that before.
If you know that you are imperfect, you are actually not that great. Uh-huh. You're great, but not the greatest.
Yes.
And you can still hold yourself in high regard, then I think you are great.
Esther, thank you so much. Appreciate you. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode and it inspired you on your journey towards greatness. Make sure to check out the show notes in the description for a full rundown of today's show with all the important links. And also make sure to share this with a friend and subscribe over on Apple Podcasts as well. I really love hearing feedback from you guys, so share a review over on Apple and let me know what part of this episode resonated with you the most. And if no one's told you lately, I want to remind you that you are loved, you are worthy, and you matter. And now it's time to go out there and do something great.